A year and a half after a Government Accountability Office GAO report revealed that the U.S. Department of Energy, DOE, has no coherent plan in place to manage nuclear waste from weapons manufacturing piling up at more than 150 sites across the country, the DOE has made little progress in developing a safe and a strategic plan to handle the waste. Meanwhile, the estimated cost of handling the material is rising steadily, $512 billion at last count, and the federal government hasn't yet figured out how to pay for it. And of course, much of the waste will have to somehow remain safely stored for 10,000 years or more, a time frame even more mind-boggling than the size of the debt. In a letter to Congress in June, GAO said the DOE's Office of Environmental Management, EM, which is charged with building facilities to treat millions of gallons of radioactive waste and remediating contaminated soil and water at nuclear weapons construction sites, needs to use factors such as costs and risks to human health and environment in determining which cleanup projects to focus on. The GAO has reported in the last decades that the DOE's cleanup policy, which governs the EM cleanup program, does not direct how EM should make environmental cleanup decisions, including how to make risk-informed cleanup decisions, even though GAO and DOE's own Inspector General had been recommending such an approach since the 1990s. The United States has about 14,000 metric tons of high-level waste and spent nuclear fuel from defense-related activities from the Second World War era through 1980s. This waste is currently stored in facilities in five states and managed by DOE. EM is responsible for handling most of the contamination at 16 sites. The cleanup cost for these sites is now estimated at $406 billion, up from an estimated $163 billion a decade ago. Other DOE offices are responsible for $106 billion more in waste handling. The increase in cost is driven by the fact that facilities are continuing to degrade while awaiting disposition, which ultimately drives up stabilization costs and final deactivation and decommissioning costs, DOE reported to Congress last year. The funding deficit accumulated over decades during Republican and Democratic administration, since the U.S. military created the waste, funding and oversight of its engagement comes mainly from Congressional Armed Services Committees. Unfortunately, the committees are mainly concerned with funding the armed forces of today and tomorrow, not clean up yesterday's garbage. A Senate Armed Services Committee report noted recently that as the United States continues to maintain and modernize its nuclear weapons stockpile, waste will continue to be generated and must be treated, stored, and disposed of. It is not clear whether there are sufficient facilities to address the waste generated by these activities or whether such facilities are included in current plans and budgets. In an emailed statement to the journal, EM said it is committed to continuous improvements in contract and project management and in reducing DOE's environmental liabilities. It added that GAO acknowledged the notable actions EM has taken to demonstrate commitment to improving its contract and project management in cleaning up some problem sites such as the East Tennessee Technology Park at Oak Ridge and the Salt Waste Processing Facility at Savannah River, South Carolina.
Shaheed.
Part 4.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Shaheed. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're going to be talking about the effects of the news of the general's assassination breaking out to people across the region and across the world. The first wave of emotions that people experienced across the region, again, and across the world, was a state of shock for those who knew him especially. But there were people who didn't know about him or the effect that he has had on the peace and stability of the region. For those, they had a little bit of digging up to do. But once they went through that and realized what an influential character had been lost, they also went through the same state of shock, along with different stages of grief. But in this particular episode, we're going to be talking to one special guest to see how she went through the different stages of grief, because she felt the general's presence in her region with her flesh and bones. Joined right now by Marwa Osman, a journalist and political commentator. Marwa, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I'm going to start with my first question about a statement that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said about the martyrdom of General Soleimani. He said that the martyr Soleimani is a lot more dangerous to his enemies than General Soleimani. How do you view that statement?
Thank you for having me. Sayyid Ali Khamenei's statement concerning the martyrdom of Haj Qasem Soleimani and how his martyrdom is way more dangerous than his actual life as Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is the hit in the eye, in the bullseye, to be honest with you. Why? Because if you haven't seen the millions of people who mourned and grieved Soleimani, not only during his funeral procession, but throughout the past 2 years, whether in their homes, in their towns, in their studies, in their research papers, in their community service to their societies, then you can then understand that it was this man's martyrdom, this man's holy blood that was spilled, was the actual motivation for all of this work, for all of this jihad, fi sabilillah. It was some sort of an igniting force that gave the peoples of the world, not only the region, not only West Asia, but the peoples of the world, they gave them the motivation. It gave them the confidence to be who they are, to be the natives, the righteous people of their land, of their decision-making process, their right to decide their future, first of all, their present and their future for the next generations, and the right to make a new alliance with a force that, in my view, will most definitely be the power that will break the unipolarity of Western imperial powers in our region and elsewhere. So with this statement, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei is just presenting to us how this loss of hero, the resistance hero, was actually a victory. Even the way that he passed was a victory to the people.
All right, moving on to the reason why you are here. You came to Iran to attend the demonstrations and the second martyrdom anniversary of General Soleimani. How did you find the vibe on the streets? And do you see it? Do you see people ever forgetting, perhaps, the fire that they have right now?
Oh no, it's never ending. It has never put out. The fire has never been put out.
Yeah.
We had a trip to Kerman to pay tribute to the shrine of Hajj Qasim and his companions, and we visited his house that was turned into a masjid, and that was absolutely emotional for each and every one of us. We met Kermanis. We met people from Kerman. Who felt like the family, the direct family of Hajj Qasim Soleimani. And we met even people in Tehran with different conferences that we attended at the Islamic Cultural Complex, and yesterday with Lady Zainab Qasim Soleimani at the Qasim Soleimani School, where it launched the first conference for scientific research, which is also very important because this is actually documenting the efforts and the victories and the achievements that were possible because of Qasim Soleimani, and how they will change and have changed the geopolitics and even furthermore the history of this region. When we talk about the emotional aspect of it, I can talk from personal experience. I came here thinking that it's going to be a nice trip, but once I got there, I stood in front of that holy shrine, I couldn't help myself. I was very emotional. I was very overwhelmed. I kept thinking that this man saved my life. This man kept my family. I'm sorry.
You know, while you try to continue your line of thought, maybe I can give you a little bit of my own experience with what happened, especially 2 years ago when it happened, and when I first turned on the TV and saw the helicopter filming the line of people, I can't really say a line of people, the flood of people filling Tehran from east to west, and I may not have gotten perhaps as emotional as you have gotten, because you mentioned that your family was saved because of him.
Yes, and these are not tears of grief. These are tears of, you know, that emotion that you have for someone, that love and passion that you have for an ideology or for someone, but at the same time you feel that you are unable to show complete tribute. You always feel that you are one step behind, that you're not really,
you cannot
fulfill. Yeah, you cannot fulfill what your heart and mind tells you.
Mm-hmm.
It was very overwhelming for me and for the group with me as well, because we felt directly in our everyday life the effect of Qasim Soleimani. It was not easy. You should have seen how Beirut and Dahiyeh turned into a military base. We had checkpoints at every entrance to Dahiyeh because we are having bombs on a regular weekly basis. And we lost a lot of family members, a lot of friends. Our security, our peace was taken away from us. We were threatened directly. I lost a couple of my very dear students at the University of Ma'arif as well, who were fighting Daesh terrorism in Syria. So it is something very personal. And to be standing there in the hazrat of such an important person, yet such a humble person. He has such a humble characteristic, such a charisma that's so close to the people, to the public.
It's written soldier on his front.
Yes, it's just soldier. And this is what he wanted. And it teaches you. It puts you on the right track of truth in your own life. And it teaches you that wherever you go, whatever your achievements are, at the end of the day, you're just a soldier in the path of Karbala, al-Haq, the path of truth, righteousness, the path of resistance, the oppressed against the oppressor.
I'm going to give Marwa a short break here. I think she definitely deserves it. So let's take a quick look at how the media reacted to the assassination attempt when it happened. So, crippling U.S. sanctions didn't bring Iran to its knees. So what now? Well, over a year and a half after the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA and slapped those sanctions on Iran, it struck a strategic target, a human target, Qasim Soleimani. But if the strike was meant to be a cunning plan, it wasn't very cunning. Obviously, because it didn't bear a fruit load for the U.S. Early media reactions to the assassination of General Soleimani, many have implied a U.S. win and upper hand over Iran. David Wormser, senior U.S. National Security Advisor, had predicted in 2019 that the Iranians would welcome a military strike on a high-ranking commander such as Qasem Soleimani. But the reaction that actually followed? Millions poured out into the streets in Iran in protest to the killing of a soldier in command. And I'm not talking millions of plainclothes jihadist soldiers. Millions demonstrated in all shapes and colors, including women without a care for hijab or affiliation to Islamic rule. It was like a nation's reaction to a declaration of war, in that it united people of all walks and tendencies in their distrust for the U.S. To make matters worse for America, Iran attacked the Ain al-Assad U.S. base in Iraq in response shortly after the assassination. It was the first official attack on a U.S. military base since World War II, and it was precise. Analyses that followed said Qasem Soleimani was the most important figure in the fight against Daesh or ISIS and al-Nusra and all Takfiri groups. So by assassinating him, the U.S. only proved its own claims of wanting Daesh and Takfiri groups dead to be false. Next, as U.S. General McKinsey responded to a show host, the attack on Ain al-Assad proved that Iranian missiles are indeed precise. What if Iran didn't have those precision missiles its JCPOA partners would so like to strip it of? Answer, Iran would be left with nothing but a lame diplomacy. So again, the Soleimani assassination only proved Iran's claim to be true, that without military clout paired with its diplomacy, this country would be vulnerable to military aggression without having any defenses. To make matters yet worse for the U.S., negative reaction to its act of terror went beyond Iran to Iraqi politicians and international legal analysts. Attack on U.S. forces increased in the region, and the Iraqi parliament was presented the legal means of expelling America on a silver platter. The very foundation of America's position in Iraq was crumbling, especially as several of Soleimani's companions were Iraqi, including another revered military man, al-Muhandis. The Iraqi foreign ministry wrote two letters to the UN Security Council chair and the UN Secretary General complaining of a U.S. attack on Iraqi military strongholds, military commanders, and a high-ranking friend of Iraq on Iraqi soil. The American attack meant an attack on Iraqi rulership and went totally against conditions set on a U.S. military presence in Iraq. And on the 7th of January 2021, Iraq's judiciary issued an arrest warrant for former U.S. President Donald Trump for the murder of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Not every American official is naive or unable to admit to failure. Richard N. Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former American diplomat, tweeted that the U.S. strike had meant an end to the era of U.S.-Iraq cooperation and an increase in Iranian influence. Now, who gave America the key to the kill, the whereabouts of the general? France 24's Middle East Matters program heard IDF's international spokesperson Jonathan Conricus say, the Israel military forces played no part in the killing of Iran's Qasem Soleimani, but the office of Benjamin Netanyahu, the then Israeli prime minister, did issue a short statement saying Israel stands with the United States in its just struggle for peace, security, and self-defense. Now that's interesting, as the U.S. had no proof or detailed allegation that Soleimani was plotting anything against it. And there was collateral damage, the deaths of accompanying drivers and security forces. The U.S. carried out an attack on the territory of a state, Iraq, without permission from that state. In fact, Soleimani went to Iraq on invitation of the Iraqi prime minister, and so said Mary Ellen O'Connell, a law professor and an expert on international disputes at the University of Notre Dame. Quote, the attack was unlawful, the assassination was not justifiable, end quote. The premeditated killing of a specific individual commander for what they have done on the battlefield or what they may do has been prohibited by the law of armed conflict dating from the Hague Conventions of 1907 and by a protocol of the Geneva Convention in 1949. International war law aside, there has been a U.S. executive order in place since 1976 forbidding the U.S. from carrying out political assassinations. You can call it state terrorism. And here's what American and Israeli media outlets said about culpability. America's NBC, for one, said that Israeli intelligence had helped America with tracing Soleimani's trip from Syria to Lebanon to Iraq. The Jerusalem Post, on the other hand, wrote that two of the people who reported Qasem Soleimani's whereabouts, his comings and goings in Syria and Lebanon, worked for Mossad, the Israeli National Intelligence Agency. Welcome back. I have still a few more questions from our dear guest, Marwa Osman. This was straight up an act of terror, right? Iranian officials have repeatedly said that the retaliation is far from over. So there's still yet to come. But when that comes, how do you think, in whatever format it will, how do you think the international media as well as social media will respond to it, knowing that they can be forgetful at times?
When the retaliation started taking place, we all remember Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq, how it was brought down. It was carpet bombed with surface-to-surface missiles, and it was the first time that Iran showed this type of force. It actually showed it before, a couple of years back, when it bombed Daesh inside the Palmyra Desert of Syria, and it shocked the world. But the Ain al-Assad Air Base was a direct hit towards the enemy, and they kept denying that anyone was
injured,
even injured. But if you look at the reports coming out from the U.S. military, in the U.S. military over the forward coming months after the hit took place, you have more than 200 soldiers, personnel, who were either killed with friendly fire or killed in action or injured with injuries that are they can never come back from, because they don't have the audacity to they don't have the self-respect to actually say that we took a hit. That's how the empire works. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that the media doesn't show, and sadly our media is a bit weaker than the empire's media, and that's understandable, but we are doing our job as much powerful as we can be. But what happened is that Israel's top general, who was directly involved in the assassination, was killed at the age of 52, heart attack. Also, a U.S. general, one of the top U.S. generals in what they call the Middle East, in West Asia, was also killed with natural causes in Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. How were these people killed, who are directly involved with the assassination with General Qasem Soleimani and Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? So retaliation will never stop. And it doesn't have to be only at the level of personnel. It can be at the level of diplomacy. It can be at the level of military. It can be at the level of weapon power.
Yeah, because they have no
arms
one
power
that can even come close to the level of what we lost.
Because in international law, my friend, the assassination, the espionage and assassination against Qasem Soleimani equals the assassination of the chief of staff, or what is called as the highest rank in the American military force. Can you imagine if that ever happened to such a Western power, what they will be doing?
I can.
It is a terrorist, it's an act of terrorism. It's a crime according to international law. It's a crime according to Iraqi law. It's a crime according to Iranian law. It's even a crime according to U.S. law itself. Yeah. But they see themselves as above the law, but our region does not even see them. That's why we will resist them. We don't fear them. If we feared them, we wouldn't have the likes of Qasem Soleimani fighting them.
Yeah. Following that same train of thought, Iran has repeatedly also mentioned that it would take legal international action against this act of terror. What do you think the correct step-by-step measure would be for Iran to actually be able to manifest something out of this legal pursuit?
Well, we had a debate the other day about that, whether or not this will give out any results, whether real results will come out from this legal aspect of pursuing to put on trial the people who were behind the assassination. Everyone who was behind the assassination, those who took the decision and those who implemented. To begin with, we don't trust international law. we don't trust the UN. We've seen how they... It's all textbooks, nice textbooks, very well written.
They show concern.
Yeah, they, very well written laws that are never, ever applied by the major powers. So we don't have trust, but we have hujjah. We have the... We need an evidence in our hands, not only on the battlefield, but in the hallways of the justice system, despite the fact that we do not trust it, but it doesn't mean that we should not be there. We should be there. Iran is a member of the United Nations. Right. It's a member of the UNSC, and it has every right to speak up and say that this was not a wrongdoing. This was an assassination. This was an act of war. Iraq has a right to do the same. And every nation in this world has a responsibility towards what happened, because this can happen to it as well, to its members, to its people. So it's part of not only solidarity, but it's a right to protect the sovereignty of nations, the independence of nations, and to abide by international law.
Let's move on to 5 days after the assassination, and when the when Iran carried out the ballistic missile attack on the Ain al-Assad airbase. In the beginning, there was little to no coverage, or even if there was coverage on international media, it was watered down quite a bit.
Yeah.
But after on, they kind of had to do their due diligence, if you want to even call it that, and start talking about the actual casualties, even if, again, still very much watered down. How do you analyze the reaction during, like, immediately after the attack, and also as time went on?
Well, let me tell you first what happened in Lebanon when the retaliatory attack by Iran happened. If you have been to Lebanon during New Year's Eve, you would understand how we celebrate. We are crazy people. We celebrate hard.
Okay.
We celebrated New Year's 5 days before that. And then on the fifth day of the assassination, after all the grief and the anger, when the retaliatory attack happened, it was non-stop celebrations all across Lebanon. It was fireworks, gunfire.
Wow.
We're crazy people when it comes to celebrations. It was something that hit hard. It was like something that we've been waiting for more than 40 years. 40 years. We've been under the suppression, an oppression, an aggression of the Zionist entity held by the hand of the United States of America. It was a revenge for every one of us. It was a revenge for Syria. It was a revenge for Sana'a. It was a revenge for Baghdad. It was a revenge for Tehran and every street in Tehran that was attacked by the Mossad. It was for every martyr that has fallen at the hands of this imperial power. It was a time for us to stand, put our heads high and say, we, the people of the world, under the patronage of the Islamic Republic of Iran, have the power to retaliate. We can stand high and say, you cannot step on us anymore. We have the power to stop you. This is how immense the situation was. But talking about the how the Western world covered or uncovered the situation that was happening, the retaliatory attacks, they tried very hard to suppress and hold back any kind of news that's coming out of the of the region. But we live in the age of the now, the real-time reporting. And social media is a very important tool, despite the fact that they control it. But it's a very important tool if you know how to manage it. The videos that we got from the soldiers themselves who were shooting the time when the ballistic missiles fell, they were priceless. Priceless. Their screams and squeaks and cries and please, oh God, help us. Who's going to help you now? This, you are feeling what we have been feeling for the past 40 years.
A taste of your own medicine.
Yes, it's the first time a bomb falls on your head, dear soldier. Well,
boo-hoo.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Marwa, for sharing us your side of the story. It's always a pleasure when you see somebody else going through a similar, maybe, I mean, very different, but in a way similar experiences when we're talking about the assassination of Marzouk Soleimani. It was also definitely very nice for me to be able to share my experience with someone that went through, again, similar but very different experience as I have. So that's going to do it for this part of the program. Let's wrap up the show.
Those who take on great responsibility rarely have time for their families. Haj Qasem Soleimani, though, was among those who find time for family, especially their parents and children, to the best of their ability. He spent every given moment to visit his parents as long as they were alive, showing respect by kissing their hands and feet. He believed their prayers and piety were one reason why God provided for his livelihood via his service to Islam and Muslims and the oppressed of the world. He believed the road to salvation and happiness in life and the afterlife was kindness to and appreciation for one's parents as a form of thanking God. He wrote to his nephew, "Dear Mehdi, respect and humbleness before elders, especially your parents, are a must. Make it a habit to kiss your mother and father's hands without inhibition, as this will both make them happy and affect you and your life positively." Mata Pur Jafari, his companion for years, says, "When his mother was hospitalized, Haj Qasem kept on kissing her and weeping. 'Dear mother, forgive me for not being a good son to you. Forgive me for not doing my duty to you, as I should have.'" Apart from parents, attention and care for his wife and the upbringing of his children were a top priority to him. The martyr's brother says, "He adored his children and brought them up to be followers of the leader of the revolution and lovers of the Prophet's household. During their education, he tried to visit their place of study at least twice a year to see how they're doing. He loved his children. However, he wouldn't allow them any economic activity by misuse of his name and position."
In this episode of The Shaheed, we focused on different aspects of the effects that the martyrdom of General has had on people's lives, as well as how it was reflected on mainstream media, as well as social media, and the support that the General had gotten from the people, especially the oppressed people and the freedom-seeking people of the world and the region. Take care. Bye-bye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz. Every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Currently, the U.S. is pursuing a nuclear weapons modernization program that was launched by the Obama-Biden administration that is expected to cost at least $1.7 trillion by 2046. This includes large spending increases on a controversial low-yield smaller nuclear warhead, the total replacement of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force, new B-21 strategic bombers, B-52 upgrades, more destructive nuclear warheads, as well as other programs. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by John Lehman, writer. This article is published under the heading, 1 year in, Biden's nuclear policies look a lot like Trump's. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Speaking at a New Hampshire campaign event in 2019, then-presidential candidate Joe Biden told the crowd, "We don't need more nuclear weapons, period." After the bluster and apocalyptic theatrics of Donald Trump, many voters hoped Biden's decades of nuclear arms control experience would bring restraint and stability to the United States' nuclear policies. In Biden's own words, "If you want a world without nuclear weapons, the United States must take the initiative to lead the world." And yet, 1 year into his presidency, Biden has continued many of the nuclear weapons programs that began or advanced under Trump. Currently, the United States is pursuing a nuclear weapons modernization program that was launched by the Obama-Biden administration that is expected to cost at least $1.7 trillion by 2046. This includes large spending increases on a controversial low-yield smaller nuclear warhead, the total replacement of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force, new B-21 strategic bombers, B-52 upgrades, more destructive nuclear warheads, as well as other programs. Additionally, on December 27th, Biden signed into law the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, a nearly $770 million military bill that includes almost $28 billion for nuclear weapons. As of September 2020, the United States had a total inventory of 5,600 stockpiled nuclear warheads, which, together with Russia, represent approximately 91% of the world's nuclear weapons. Compared to his predecessor, Biden has been more transparent in disclosing nuclear budget, stockpile and dismantlement figures, says Hans Christensen, director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. For his increased transparency, the extension of a major arms treaty, and for initiating strategic talks with Russia and China, Christensen gives Biden a grade of B. With respect to the incomplete disclosure and slowing rate of dismantling retired nuclear warheads, however, he gives Biden a C. Furthermore, he is concerned Biden's forthcoming nuclear posture review might not adopt a no-first-use nuclear weapons policy. Christensen told Truth Out, "Biden's general military strategy and foreign policy are beefing up offensive capabilities and posturing in response to Russia and China. Many see that as necessary to deter those countries, but it may also work to stimulate their activities further. On the plus side, Biden earned widespread praise for extending the New START treaty, which limits U.S. and Russian-deployed long-range nuclear weapons before it was set to expire 2 weeks into his presidency. Darrell Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, called the extension an important and common-sense step. John Tierney, a former congressman and executive director of the nonprofit Council for a Livable World, described the treaty's extension as one bright spot in Biden's first year, which he said was a serious disappointment otherwise. On the whole, the Biden administration has rubber-stamped every major big budget nuclear weapon system produced under the Trump administration. Tierney told Truth Out. He further criticized Biden for failing to miss low-hanging fruit, including opportunities to cancel a new unnecessary and wasteful submarine-launched ballistic missile nuclear warhead, a life extension program for the outdated B-83 megaton gravity bomb, and more usable nuclear weapons. At the moment, Tierney said, we must give Biden a C-, a passing grade, but only barely. Grassroots movement Beyond the Bombs executive director Cecily Thompson-Williams told Truthout that even though Biden has a stated support for a no-first-use policy, a more rational nuclear posture has not been a Biden administration priority. Thompson-Williams said, without that leadership, nuclear hawks at the Department of Defense are once again succeeding in their resistance to the common-sense changes to make nuclear policy safer. Also giving Biden a C-, she called his first year disappointing, but with potential to improve. In September, 29 members of Congress wrote to Biden to implore him to reduce excessive spending and over-reliance on nuclear weapons. This was followed by a letter to the president sent in December and signed by almost 700 scientists and engineers calling for a reduction in the role of nuclear weapons in the U.S. national security.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's a massive problem of homelessness in the UK. And it seems to be getting worse during the COVID-19 pandemic. There's also an ethnic bias in the statistics, with black households more likely to suffer the issues of homelessness than the white population. How can this be happening in a country with considerable wealth and one of the six largest economies in the world? One striking contrast is the difference in the life of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has all the advantages of personal wealth and an apartment in Downing Street, while every night many sleep rough within sight of the street where he lives, but a million miles from how he lives. It's a situation that has been brought to prominence by the current pandemic, as key issues associated with homelessness have been left unresolved, while the government struggles with a host of problems in relation to the rapid spread of the disease through the general population. COVID's impact has left a mark on the most vulnerable in terms of housing and homelessness. in most difficulty, those in emergency accommodation, plus the large community of rough sleepers, carry on trying to cope in temporary accommodation or in the streets of London and beyond. They represent a large group of residents of a country hit by an accommodation epidemic, as the government seems unable to fix one of the biggest and most pressing problems facing hundreds of thousands of men, women and children in Britain.
How does the public feel about a Prime Minister living in luxury while many face accommodation problems or sleep rough not far from his Whitehall residence? And what do thousands living in the streets of Britain's capital city tell us about the state of the nation and its future prospects? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do those in the capital feel about the homeless situation in the UK? That's what we asked people here in East London. This is what they told us.
It's very, very tough. Either they put the rent very high, the private landlord, they got the rent is higher. Number two, the homeless, too many. In Tower Hamlet, too many drugs, too many things going on, too many. Even the mayor of Tower Hamlet, he don't care. We have complained to our councillors and the members. They don't bother anything. They don't care about these things.
Of course, no one likes to stay in the outside of homes in the streets, but the conditions and the life is pushed towards people to that way.
I don't know. This is just an opinion. I think it's probably on the rise. I think there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. Yeah.
You don't have the place to sleep in. You're sleeping outside. So it's very terrible.
Well, I'm not very happy about it. I think they should have more help rather than seeing them sleeping in the street in a big city like London. I don't think it should happen. That's my thing about it, really.
Honestly, I feel like it's a bit dumb that people ain't helping the homeless to get better shelter, if you get what I mean.
I think it seems like a big problem. I mean, when you're walking the streets of London, you can see that there are a lot of people who are sleeping outdoors and they're looking for a place to stay, and particularly over Christmas when the winter months are really, really cold.
I think the homeless crisis that we have in the UK is just rising. So if you look at Australia, India, even America, it's just rising, and we've got to make a difference in the UK ourselves.
They have to sleep outside, and it's not good for us and for the community, for the state.
You know, everywhere I go, majority of the time, I see people, you know, and obviously it's terrible, especially this time of year, you know what I mean? Everyone's cold and people are looking for shelter and stuff like that.
Well, I've got a friend that's homeless, and I met a couple people. Well, they tell me their story, how people treat them, whereas they're not treated right. There's a lot of prejudice going on. You know, it's sad, to be honest. Like, I've even helped homeless people create a home, like build.
So, yeah, it's not great, and especially with COVID going on, it's getting worse for them as well, but I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what the solution is.
Oh, it's devastating. It's very prevalent.
I think it's really appalling, really. I think it's that, you know, 2021, we've got this going on, and I think we should do something about it.
The Prince Philip should, and the Prime Minister should, build good housing for them, like mars, give them a special tree, because they're homeless. Instead of normal houses, they build for people made of sand and stones.
How do you feel about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain? Because there is a lot. 200,000 people, in fact.
Yeah, it's a really big figure, and it's really alarming for the UK citizens, yeah, definitely.
Especially in UK, it's quite disappointing to see people are still rough sleeping, and especially in this poor weather and during pandemic, it's difficult.
Just for people, it's too expensive, the rent prices and stuff.
There's so many of them. I've lived in Britain since 1989. I have never seen that many homeless people ever in my life before.
What do you think about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain now?
Well, because I think the inequality is, increasing. So social system is breaking down, and that's why the homelessness is there.
As Boris Johnson lives comfortably in his Downing Street apartment, others live rough in the streets of the capital. How does the public feel about that?
He's the Prime Minister of UK, so he has to live in a security place. He can't live just like us ordinary people.
If Prime Minister lives in a warm place, he must ensure that people which he rules, they should stay in the warm houses, at least in Christmas, I think.
Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, I think he doesn't give a toss about what's happening on the street, to be honest.
So I don't think it's fair for him to have a certain rule for himself and the rest. We have the rules of seeing people sleeping outside, you know. I mean, I'm not a rich man, but if I had more space, I'll invite somebody in my house to for the night.
Honestly, I don't think he really cares about homeless people. Like, he only cares for himself, if you know what I'm saying. Like, apparently he's been partying along like, around the coronavirus time, so I don't think he's a great Prime Minister for us to actually do it.
I think he's looking at the national security, he's got other issues on his mind. Now, I think with the homeless is that just like we do a petition for everything, why don't we do a petition for the homeless?
He don't bother anybody. He's a joker. A real joker. Real comedian. Our minister is a real comedian.
To be honest, I don't think Boris has done enough for a lot of things. I think in his mind, the homeless crisis is probably bottom of his list.
No, he hasn't, but at the same time, he's got way more on his plate as well. Yes, it's always been an issue, and homelessness is something that's an issue everywhere in the world, not just in London and England.
I don't feel as though he's addressed the issue in an adequate way whatsoever. Sadly, though, I feel as his policies are part of a larger conservative agenda to minimise spending and focus on finance in London, which is a shame. But I don't feel like he's kind of a puppet of the Conservative Party, so it's not essentially his problem. It's more of an issue with the changing dynamic of politics in Britain.
Oh, we need to change all of our behaviour, thinking and attitudes as well. It's not for only Boris Johnson, it's also the people thinking. We need to change this one.
This is really disgusting that some people are too wealthy and other people have nothing to sleep.
Boris Johnson is Boris Johnson, isn't it? He can afford it. That's his job.
I don't know how the people like him or me can sleep in peace while the other people are sleeping rough.
It's hard for me to say, really. I think in terms of the amount of money that's going towards the scheme and in terms of helping other homeless people, it's more money definitely could go into places that need it most, you know, to deprived areas, which can be across all of England.
Why has homelessness gone up so much in the UK? And has COVID had an impact?
I think last 2 years, maybe a pandemic has affected this because, you know, most of the people became unemployed. But I think the main reason here is there is a strict, you know, common rules in here, and community don't want to accept someone who not belongs to their, you know, who not familiar with them.
Well, I think there's different reasons. First of all, like, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of the Brexit has had a massive impact on like people applying for benefits and so on. And then also I think the refugees is another one, and
maybe people are not giving it more thought, you know. And I'm not saying to demonstrate about it, but just to make your opinions known and your feeling, you know. Positive action and non-violence, that's it.
The lockdown, which has now taken away people's jobs so they can't actually get a job, or something else that has happened in their family.
Because there are more people who are struggling to find a job, they're struggling to earn money, and that there's not enough places for them to live.
I think that's because of the government spending is going towards war and so on.
Especially during COVID and stuff like that, I imagine loads of these places, you know, shut down, like the hostels and certain places where homeless people would have, you know, like an outlet almost, somewhere to go and somewhere to stay. And obviously, during COVID, it's that messed up a lot of things, I'd imagine.
Less jobs. Economy maybe.
Well, partially it's due to the pandemic, obviously, with people losing their jobs and whatnot. Rising inflation, all of these things take a part into it as well.
I feel as though freer, well, sort of freer liberal markets in Britain, and us having the paradigm of neoliberalism is squeezing the amount of spending that governments can focus on it. Things like economic crises become broader issues, which are taken more of a priority.
I think housing probably. A lot to do with housing. There's a lot of people coming into the country as well, which is also probably contributing to not enough beds, not enough spaces.
There are not accurate policies in place to make sure that everyone is taken care of appropriately.
Well, myself, I'm self-employed, and I felt a big difference, yeah, to be honest. You know, before COVID and now, it's much difficult to get clients and, you know, make more money.
As long as I know, COVID, during the COVID lockdown and things, you know, they did increase that, you know, that accommodation so people were, given the accommodation. But definitely financially, mentally and physically, people are suffering a lot, actually, yes.
Here's the size of the problem. 11,580 single households were assessed as sleeping rough when asked. That's an increase of 39.4% compared to 2019-20. Families involving black ethnicity are disproportionately homeless. They account for 9.7% of those officially seen as needing support, but they only make up 3.5% of the population. Overall, in 2019-20, over 258,000 received homelessness assistance, a huge number for one of the world's most wealthy countries.
How do people here in the city feel about the fact that a first world country such as Britain still has so many individuals living in a housing crisis or even sleeping rough?
Well, most of them is drugs, alcoholics, and this for this reason they don't want to get into flat, because if the government give them a flat, they can't pay the rent. They can't pay the rent, they can't keep the flat maintained. So how can the government will help them out?
I was thinking that the Britain is one of the most wealthy countries in the world. But when I came here, I saw a lot of people in cities. They were living in streets and literally they were eating from the no garbage.
I think we're very selfish. We don't really care about people next door. I think we're losing the sense of community, and until we go back to this community, minded people, that we're not going to sort homelessness or any other issue, poverty or whatever, drugs or whatever.
I'm just surprised it's happening. The money is here. They could do it if they want to do it. This is how I feel about it.
We've been supported by three different countries, and we still can't provide for people to actually become stable. And I feel like that's upon our Prime Minister and other associates.
There's always a solution if you want to find it, I would say. If people say there's not a magic money tree, but I guess if you really wanted to find the money, then you probably could somewhere. It's just where that money's going and where the government wants to prioritise.
Well, like Indira Gandhi said once, do you know what she said? I'll move from Bombay all the poor, so there will be no poor in India, Bombay. And Mr. Boris Johnson will do the same. Move all the poor from London and it will be reach London.
People aren't, I feel like we're not doing enough. I feel like we're focused on the wrong things, you know what I mean? On the news every morning, it's this and that. You know, there's always another problem, and majority of the time it's about COVID or... But yeah, I just feel like there's so many problems at the moment that...
In life, you usually just focus on yourself. But, you know, it's also nice to think about other people. But you see, the people up there, the Prime Minister and stuff, they only think about themselves.
When you're dealing with things like homelessness, just giving them money isn't going to fix the issue. They need to learn what to do with the money, how to make the money stretch for them further, you know, what to do with investing, pensions, getting jobs, things like that.
Governments are disassociated from people in Britain. And the other issues have become a higher priority, such as sort of economic sustainability.